Good morning, and welcome to the Covanta Holding Corporation's first quarter 2022 conference call. This call is being recorded, and an archived recording will be available after the end of the conference call and can be accessed through the Debt Investor Information section of Covanta's Investor Relations website. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Jim Riley, Covanta's Treasurer. Please go ahead.
Thank you and good morning. Welcome to Covanta's first quarter 2022 financial results conference call. Joining me on the call today will be Brad Helgeson, our CFO. After our prepared comments, we will take your questions. During the prepared remarks, we will be referencing certain slides that we prepared to supplement the call. Those slides can be accessed now or after the call on the Investor Relations section of our website, www.covanta.com. These prepared remarks should be listened to in conjunction with these slides. Call participants should also see the earnings release for a discussion of our usage of forward-looking statements and non-GAAP financial measures. Before I hand the call off to Brad, I'd like to note that Covanta finalized an amendment to its credit agreement effective yesterday that increased the commitment on the revolving credit facility from $440 million to $600 million. The increase was supported by 100% of our existing revolving lenders, who each committed to their pro rata share of the increase, and we want to thank our relationship banks for their continued support. The increase in commitment represents a significant step in our efforts to proactively and prudently maintain adequate liquidity to support the business and our energy risk management activities. With that, I'd now like to turn the call over to Brad.
Thanks, Jim. Good morning, everyone. I'll begin with a review of some key performance indicators for the business on slide three. In the waste energy business, the story for the quarter is straightforward. Production volumes were a bit lower than the first quarter of 2021, which I'll explain, while pricing was up strongly across the board, continuing the well-established trend in waste tip fee growth and reflecting very favorable commodity end markets. Regarding waste-to-energy production volume, there were a few factors to point out. First, this quarter reflected a heavier planned maintenance outage schedule as compared to Q1 last year, with approximately 35% of anticipated maintenance expense this year already incurred through March, versus a little over 30% at that point last year. This resulted in nearly 10% more scheduled down days year over year. We also experienced additional unplanned downtime at a few plants heading into their maintenance outages, where we addressed some specific known issues. Keep in mind that modest variability in production on a quarter-to-quarter basis, both positive and negative, is typical for this business, but as you've seen in our consistent operating results over many years, these even out over time. This year should be no different, as we expect waste-to-energy plant production to be consistent again overall for 2022. On the revenue pricing side, waste-to-energy tip fees were up over 5% again year-over-year, reflecting inflation-linked escalators under long-term contracts, higher pricing on new contracts, and favorable waste mix, including higher profiled waste volume. An offsetting benefit of lower production volume in a given period, which may not be intuitively obvious, is better price mix on waste as we prioritize higher priced tons when utilizing available plant capacity. Strong waste disposal pricing power with our unique and irreplaceable asset base in the Northeast market, with shrinking landfill capacity and increasing costs for long-haul waste transportation, remains a meaningful long-term secular tailwind for the company's value and credit. Energy prices, looking at the overall average of market, hedged, and contracted output, were up over 30% year over year. This reflects stronger prices across the generation portfolio, including contracts where output is priced at avoided cost, higher hedged prices as we locked in at a strengthening forward curve over time, and of course, higher market prices, which more than doubled year over year. Bottom line, it's a great time to be a power generator, but Covanta is especially well positioned in this environment because we don't face higher prices for our feedstock. Instead, our fuel is a sustainable waste solution and our biggest revenue source. We also have continued to see a very strong recycled metals market, with average realized sales prices for ferrous scrap up over 10% and non-ferrous up over 15% year over year. I'll now discuss the drivers of revenue more specifically. Please refer to slide four. Revenue was $551 million in the first quarter, up 11% compared to Q1 2021, with strength across the board. Higher energy prices, including RECs, contributed $25 million to revenue growth, while higher market prices for recycled metal, both ferrous and non-ferrous, added $6 million. As previously noted, tip fee prices increased by over 5% year-over-year, or $8 million in revenue terms. In addition, contractual escalators drove a $5 million increase in service fee revenue. Our environmental solutions platform continues to grow rapidly, offering a menu of sustainable options for commercial and industrial customers who are increasingly looking for non-landfill alternatives for their waste. Revenue at our material processing facilities grew by $7 million in the quarter, or nearly 20% year over year. Turning to adjusted EBITDA, I'll refer to slide five. Adjusted EBITDA was $98 million in the first quarter, which was flat on a year-over-year basis. Essentially, strong price growth was offset by lower waste-to-energy production volume on a comparable basis, which I discussed earlier, and higher maintenance expense related to the heavier planned outage schedule compared to last year. We also experienced higher cost inflation for items such as wages, transportation, and consumables. But as I've said before, this business performs very well in an inflationary environment overall. Any inflation that we see on the cost side is offset by multiples on the top line across waste, energy, and recycled metal revenue. As operating variability normalizes across the balance of the year, the underlying trends point to solid growth in adjusted EBITDA on a full-year basis. Now please turn to slide six, where I'll walk through free cash flow on a year-over-year basis. Adjusted free cash flow was negative $6 million in the first quarter, down $16 million on a year-over-year basis, with heavier planned maintenance capex compared to Q1 2021 and higher interest expense associated with the new EQT acquisition capital structure. As a reminder, the first quarter typically represents the seasonal low point for cash generation in this business, as it is always the heaviest maintenance outage period, and this year was particularly heavy. Turning to the balance sheet on slide seven, we ended the first quarter with $3.4 billion in total debt. On a pro forma LTM basis, the leverage ratio as defined in the indenture to the 2029 notes and consistent with the corresponding measure in our credit agreement was 5.88 times at March 31, up slightly compared to year end, but down from September as presented during the November debt syndication. As a reminder, both pro forma adjusted EBITDA and net debt in this calculation as presented exclude the unrestricted subsidiaries. We had $154 million in availability under our revolving credit facility at quarter end. As Jim discussed, we recently expanded our revolving credit facility from $440 million to $600 million in order to bolster our liquidity position. In addition to greater flexibility to make investments opportunistically, this increase will provide additional support for our energy hedge book. Stepping back, higher energy prices are great for Covanta, as you've seen in recent financial results. In a world of structurally higher energy prices, the value of this business is greater and the credit is stronger. However, we have a disciplined energy risk management program under which we fix prices for up to 80% of our output on a rolling 36-month basis. And as market prices continue to rise, these hedges reflect non-cash mark-to-market losses. The mark-to-market liability on these hedges was $183 million at March 31, as you can see in our quarterly report released this morning, and has moved higher since then as energy prices have continued to rise. Depending on the security arrangements in place with our counterparties, we often need to post liquid collateral against these liabilities above agreed-upon credit thresholds in the form of letters of credit or cash. Of course, our hedges are always settled in conjunction with physical generation, so they never represent naked cash liabilities in any scenario, but they can require collateral nonetheless. With the revolver upsize, we now have over $300 million of available excess liquidity, and we're actively pursuing means of reducing the collateral requirements of the hedge book and further increasing liquidity in this very positive but volatile price environment. In conclusion, business conditions overall are highly supportive of the Covanta model, and we're focused on delivering strong growth in adjusted EBITDA on a year-over-year basis in 2022. With that, we'll move to the Q&A portion of the call. Operator, would you please open the line for questions?
We will now begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star, then two. At this time, we will pause momentarily to assemble our roster.
I'm going to get Baird first.
Our first question comes from Brian DiRubbio with Baird. Please go ahead with your question.
Just a few questions for me. I guess starting off with the new expanded credit facility, have the terms fundamentally changed in terms of interest rates or just fees?
This is Jim. No, Brian, no changes in material terms to the credit agreement. It's really just an increase in commitment. The only thing I'd note is on the revolving portion of the credit agreement, we did convert that to SOFR and from LIBOR, but the spread is the same. So
okay.
I wouldn't see that as material.
Got it. And then the $137 million you have in funds restricted held in trust, what do those represent? I know last quarter we talked about this. You had some because of some cash collateralization of LCs, but then you moved that over to the new revolver. Just want to get a sense of what that 137 is, because you are using that as part of your net debt calculation.
Right. So 100 million of that 137, Brian, is the cash from the Term Loan C, right? So it's a direct offset to the Term Loan C on the balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
The remaining 37 is candidly spread across, both the domestic project debt restricted accounts, as well as, other short-term restricted accounts supporting different activities.
Okay. That's helpful. Just going to the financial statements, obviously these were cut on 331. The decision to move the European assets occurred after that. But there was, going through the cash flow statement, there was $77 million that was invested in, it was investment in equity affiliates. I'm assuming that represents cash investments made into the assets that are no longer part of the credit group?
Brian, that's correct.
So just to be clear, so that cash went out to those investments, and then the investments were removed per the RP capacity, but there's no reimbursement for that $77 million, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. That's just want to make sure that I get all my ducks in a row there. And then just finally on pricing, you had mentioned that there was a benefit, that you got from, from mix because you had the plant outages. Can you quantify what that benefit was on pricing?
It's Brad Helgeson. It's difficult to specifically quantify how much of it was related to mix, and then the reason is there's so many moving parts around the different waste streams at each of the plants. But clearly that was a theme. I would though sort of caveat it with the comment that it was a factor, but it was very much on the edges. If you look at overall waste tip-free growth, on average across the portfolio of north of 5%, the biggest drivers of that were contractual escalation, which is tied to inflation indices, and of course that's been running hotter than it has for us really at any time in memory. As we're resetting contracts, we're doing so at higher prices in a very favorable environment for waste disposal assets. So, I wanted to highlight the mix because it is in there as a factor, but really isn't the main driver.
Okay, and actually I do have one last one. Just on the tons sold of ferrous and non-ferrous, down a lot more sharply than, you know, the amount of volumes that you have processed. Anything to take away from there?
Yeah, so there's, and this is exactly why actually we report both what's recovered and what's sold. The recovered is what would correlate pretty closely, of course, with how much waste we process in a given period. The amount sold can move up or down with increases or decreases in inventory. So it's basically, you know, when because the metal is recovered and shipped from the waste to energy facility more or less real time, and then, you know, the timing at which that then is then sold, because a lot of it comes to our centralized processing facility in Pennsylvania, where we process and upgrade the facility and then sell it. Often you have timing lags and an inventory builds associated with that material. So, long story short, it just introduces a kind of normal fluctuation period to period around that number.
Great, I appreciate that color. That's all for me. Thank you.
Thanks.
Our next call or question comes from Mike Turgle with Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, guys. Thanks for holding the call and for taking the question. Appreciate the time. A couple questions, I guess. On the past call, it sounded like there would be some margin pressures. It sounded like, I thought, from fuel, labor, et cetera. But looking at the reconciliation on slide 5, maybe that's all wrapped up in the 10 and the 5, the 10 and the 5 and maintenance and other. Is that fair to say, or did those pressures not really materialize in the quarter? How would you characterize, I guess, that 10 and 5 decrement from the previous Q1?
Yeah, it's Brad. So we absolutely did feel that pressure, as I noted briefly in the prepared remarks. It is essentially reflected and netted with some other factors in the five in that reconciliation. Essentially, if I unpack the five a little bit, we had higher medical benefit. Let me unpack the part that first pull out the part that isn't what we're about to talk about. So, we had higher medical benefit experience in the first quarter compared to the first quarter last year. We're self-insured on medical, so as people are increasingly getting out and seeing their doctors and having elective procedures, some of that expense is now coming back to us. We saw a significant decline in that expense during the COVID period. So that's part of it on a negative from an EBITDA perspective. And the other is we typically will have construction revenue and expense that will enter into construction agreements for construction projects with municipal clients that own the waste energy plant that we operate for them. It's not a big overall profit driver, but we do sometimes make a margin on that business, and that was just, again, based purely on the timing of some of these projects coming on and rolling off. That was a negative in the quarter as well. You pull those out, and that other number is essentially flat, which means that the waste price growth the waste price growth, so tip fees and service fees, essentially were offset by cost inflation, just the regular escalation of our ongoing costs, which of course now are running hotter than they have in the past. Now the waste price growth is running hotter as well. So just the way the numbers fell out in the quarter, those essentially offset. Of course, what isn't in that math is the 30 plus million of higher commodity-based revenue growth from price that we have elsewhere in the reconciliation. In total across the revenue line items, you know, as I mentioned in the prepared remarks, you know, we made up for multiples of what we saw on the cost side, but it was there. And depending on how you want to line up these line items, it was, in this presentation, offset by waste price growth.
Mm, got it. Okay, that's helpful. And that waste price growth, I assume, is based on the contract renewals, and as they, you know, continue, that will roll through the rest of the year. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that'll continue to roll through. And there is a bit of a lag where, obviously, as we've all seen, you know, we're seeing much higher inflation prints, you know, in recent months. It typically will take a full year for all of those inflation prints to reset in the contracts, where we'll typically have you know, annual resets, and those, you know, based on the really the fiscal calendars of our municipal clients, those tend to be heaviest actually, you know, mid-year and later in the year. So we saw some of that, you know, last year, you know, that's rolled through, but there's much more to come as we move through the year.
Mm, helpful. Got it. And then I think I've had this issue in the past, but having trouble reconciling cash flow for the quarter, the $77 million that went out that the previous caller had a question about, I presume that's not in the EBITDA calc, and yet cash on the balance sheet was up by $24 million. The revolver balance was down by $46 million, so that would imply a lot of cash flow. I'm missing something in there. I'm just curious what the difference is.
Yeah, for that one, maybe I'll suggest if you could follow up with Jim, you know, and we'll go through the cash flow statement line by line. It's just probably a difficult exercise right now on the fly on the call.
Yep, that's fair. Okay, thanks. That's all for me. Appreciate the time.
Our next question comes from Nikhil Jain with Genworth Financial. Please go ahead with your question.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for the call. So, just have a few questions on the business, and I also actually wanted to clarify the cash flow line item. So, maybe I'll just follow up on that and hold off on that. So, just one on the recent kind of Moody's action on the unsecured note. What sort of conversations you had with Moody's? I'm just curious in the sense that, you know, obviously the business is growing, and I think you just made a comment that you are evaluating options on the collateral posting, in the sense, maybe you can give some more color on what are you evaluating. So, you know, I'm just trying to get my arms around kind of what happened with Moody's and then what actions you're taking around the collateral.
Yeah. Hi, Nikhil. This is Jim. So, you know, we are, you know, in regular contact with both agencies, you know, have been since the transaction closed, and have been for many years, right, as a public company. You know, to cover the second piece first, perhaps, right, so we increased the revolver, as we noted. The other primary initiative that we've been working on is transitioning some of our existing energy risk hedge book from traditional ISDA CSAs that require cash and or letters of credit to lien-based structures where the counterparty would rely on sharing the security package with the banks. All right, so that's our primary focus right now with different counterparties, and you know it's an ongoing process, but we're you know engaged on it as well as a handful of other initiatives just to you know maintain adequate liquidity, right, to support the business and risk management. You know, as far as the Moody's action, you know, I'm not sure we can really comment on it beyond what I would probably say is that when the deal was structured, I think it was a capital structure that had already, to some degree, tried to optimize and maximize secured capacity such that an increase in that secured debt, could hit a tipping point, right? And I just provide that as context. I obviously can't speak for them, but I think that's the context I would put in it.
Yeah, and Arv, this is Brad. I'll add on a little bit. So, our, and not commenting on the Moody's opinion specifically, but certainly our view is there are really two points here. The first point, which I alluded to in the prepared remarks, is the fact that unambiguously, higher power prices are good for this business. It's good for the credit. It's good for everything. Period. The second point is a notching point, the unsecured versus the secured. And the reality is, and this is, obviously what Moody's was responding to in terms of the notching of the unsecured, a lot of our solution to supporting the hedge book has required us to tap further into our secured debt capacity, with additional revolver and indirectly with having hedge counterparties share in the collateral pool. So, that's sort of not to dismiss it, but it is what it is.
Okay. So as you kind of move forward with like the new, with kind of moving towards, structuring it on a lien base, what is that? Does that like basically free up your revolver more? Like, I'm just maybe trying to understand like what would be the changes that we would see once that happens. So presumably your cash would free up because you're basically providing them a lien on that you share, that they're going to share with the bank. Is that how I should think about that?
It's pretty simple. So to the extent that we have cash and or letters of credit posted with a counterparty today, if we're able to transition that counterparty to instead rely on the collateral package under the credit agreement, then we'll get that cash and LC's back, and that then dollar for dollar would increase our liquidity and reduce our reliance on the revolver. I think I would also just sort of overall make the comment, just around the logic of that structure. And this is the conversation we have with our counterparties, and I think our counterparties understand, but, we are not a trading operation, right? We're not taking positions that would ever result in a cash liability for us. We own the physical generating assets that run 24/7, and we limit our hedging activity to a level where we always have excess physical generation every hour, every day that we have hedged, so that as we deliver the electricity, that's when we settle the hedges. So I think it's just important to kind of restate, what it is we're talking about. And so I think that the collateral that we have posted, in many ways represents, belt and suspenders for the exposure that the counterparty really does face. But nonetheless, it's the way that these arrangements have been structured in the past, and it's where we are, and we're just trying to deal with it.
Got it. So is there, prices have gone up, this quarter too. So on the energy side, should we expect that essentially you'll need to post more collateral? So that means the liquidity you have right now, that's going to get squeezed further until to the point where, unless you're able to, move them to the collateral sharing agreement. And on just on that point, like, do the banks need to approve that? So where do you kind of stand, with that part of the negotiation?
Yeah, well let me quickly, just so I don't forget, let me answer that last question first, and then I'll come back to the first part. So we have the ability in the covenant package and the credit agreement to essentially have energy hedge counterparties as secured parties under the credit agreement. So the lenders have already agreed to it in the original agreement, and so we're seeking to avail ourselves of that flexibility, which again, I think is the benefit of everybody. As far as the potential for additional collateral, so we've had to post additional collateral since the end of the quarter, as I mentioned. I mentioned we have available liquidity at this moment of north of $300 million. The collateral that we've already posted is based on forward prices as they are right now. And so to the extent that we see further increases in forward prices out the curve, that could potentially require posting of additional collateral. Of course, EBITDA goes up, cash flow goes up, everything is moving in the right direction in that scenario for the company, but that could potentially require additional collateral. And that's exactly why we wanted to and continue to seek additional ways to increase our liquidity position, is to give ourselves more than adequate cushion, and I'll underscore more than adequate cushion against potential calls for additional collateral.
Okay, that's all very helpful. Thank you. So you expect to wrap that up in Q2, essentially all of this, or it's going to take longer than that?
Well, I think it's an ongoing process. So the revolver, as Jim mentioned, we completed that yesterday. So we have that additional availability now. The other initiatives, including restructuring the security of the hedge agreements. There are different counterparties that are in different stages of the discussions. We would like to make significant progress across all those fronts in the second quarter. Yeah, but then, as I said, this is going to be, I think, an ongoing focus, and we're always going to look to put ourselves in a better liquidity position beyond the second quarter.
Great, thank you. And just one question, and I'll get back in the queue on just clarification on the European subsidiaries kind of moving out now of the restricted group. So should we, with that, that's already been concluded now, right, post first quarter. So should we now kind of see where, like, you still have project debt listed and the restricted cash that's tied to maybe project debt P&I? How should we be thinking about that? Should that kind of, those line items kind of change now?
No. So actually, those line items already, excuse me, I'm battling the vestiges of a cold that just won't go away. So those balances on the balance sheet actually relate to domestic project debt and domestic assets. So the European non-recourse project debt was actually always deconsolidated or has been for several years. So the separation from a credit perspective has already happened. So we've already designated those subsidiaries as unrestricted. So they're out of the pro forma credit ratio, for example. We're actually looking to close the separation legally over the next month.
Got it. All right. Thanks for the clarification there. Thank you.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Kevin Ma with Nationwide Mutual. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for hosting the call and taking questions. Appreciate your time. Just to follow up the prior caller's question on waiting, are there any kind of like a longer term waiting targets or leverage targets you guys trying to manage to?
Hi, it's Brad. No, not specifically. I think what we've very clearly certainly communicated to the rating agencies and broadly, and I'll do so again, we will look to delever the company over time. This is a business that over time generates a lot of free cash flow. EQT has been very explicit with their intention to never take a cash dividend out of the business. So all the cash that we generate will stay in the business. That will then delever the company either by investing for growth, which would certainly be our first priority, and then delever the company that way, or in the absence of those opportunities during any particular period, go to reduce debt. We haven't put any sort of artificial targets or constraints on the capital allocation decisions that we're going to be making over the next few years, but all of them will result in a company that has a stronger credit profile over time. And as far as the ratings, same thing. We don't have a specific ratings goal. Our expectation would be that as the company and its credit profile strengthens over time, that the ratings will reflect that.
Got it. No, I appreciate it. And then just kind of one last question. With the Moody's still on negative outlook, are you guys expecting kind of further rating action down the road, or just kind of like trying to get more color regarding your conversation with Moody's and other rating agencies?
Kevin, this is Jim. I think the short answer to that is no, but listen, we maintain steady dialogue with them and will continue to do so. As Brad noted, right, our intent is to improve the credit over time. So there's nothing I'd point to now, right?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, when the rating agencies have an outlook, that then becomes something that they need to resolve specifically one way or the other in a relatively short period of time. So, they'll be looking to do that.
Great. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Omar Jama with Guardian. Please go ahead with your question.
Hello.
Morning.
My question is, good morning. It was on the $77 million equity affiliate payment. Should we expect to see any additional payments in this line item over the next several quarters?
Omar, this is Jim. The answer to that is no. The separation of the European business, in STEP means, Covanta is no longer required to fund the continued equity investments in that platform. So I'd expect, that 77 that went out in Q1, which was earmarked, almost entirely for the Rookery project that came into operation. We shouldn't see any more of that going forward.
Okay. And then the restricted funds held in trust balance declined from 235 to 137 million. What are those funds for?
Yeah, so the biggest step there was when the transaction closed last year, we had legacy letters of credit outstanding with our former agent bank that we cash collateralized at close as a first step to then transitioning those letters of credit onto the revolver or under the Term Loan C. So we posted a certain amount of cash with that counterparty that shows up on the Q4 balance sheet, and about $110 million of that representing that collateral backstop. Over the course of the first quarter, we did transition those letters of credit to the revolver and or the Term Loan C, so that cash was returned to us and was unrestricted cash on our balance sheet and used in the operations, right?
Okay. And then the seasonality in the business, obviously power prices are a lot higher now than they were even a month or two ago, but you're largely hedged. Do you typically have better quarters in 2Q and 3Q just due to seasonality?
This is Brad. We do. I think the first quarter is far and away the low from a seasonality perspective, the low point of the year. Again, driven primarily by the by the maintenance outage schedule. It used to be that power prices were highest in the summer and lower in the winter. In recent years, it's you know, you sort of had really two peak periods. The summer still is good time for power, but the winter has become the high season for power prices with the all of the demands on gas. You know, so we saw some of that, of course, in the first quarter, but the maintenance outage schedule really is the driving factor of cash generation, you know, in the quarter. You know, and then over the balance of the year, you know, we'll see much, much stronger results, EBITDA and cash, on a seasonal basis in Qs 2, 3, and 4. You know, the specific, you know, rank ordering of which is the best quarter, it does move around a little bit from year to year. But generally, the second half is overwhelmingly stronger because in the second quarter, you know, you're moving into the, you know, more of a shoulder period for power prices. And in the second quarter, we're actually finishing up the early, late winter, early spring outage schedule. So you still have a little bit of that to kind of work through in the second quarter. So really the long story short is, you know, the business is very second half weighted, you know, without necessarily predicting Q3 versus Q4 on an EBITDA and cash basis.
Okay. And then the last thing I would say is the, you know, there's a lot of questions around the $77 million payment. On the last call, you said there would be no payments. I understand that maybe these payments occurred before or were scheduled before you made those comments or kind of grandfathered in. But I think that's one potential issue going forward, is that that continues to be the case, that you don't make a lot of equity payments, since that's kind of what you said you would do, even though you, of course, have the flexibility to do so under all your RP baskets, which are quite generous. So that's more of a comment. Thank you very much for your time.
Our next question comes from Kareem Mansour with White Box Advisors. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, this relates again to your operating costs. I know that a lot of your contracts have inflation-based escalators. Was inflation simply so much stronger than the escalators that it essentially drove your operating costs? Or did you guys, like you alluded to earlier, the higher medical insurance during the period drove that line item to ultimately kind of see the margin compression shown for the quarter?
Yeah, this is Brad. Essentially, the inflation, just the way the numbers ended up in the quarter, the inflation benefit that we saw in the waste revenue line items more or less offset on a same store basis. And so this is where there's, you know, it isn't necessarily as simple as looking at the P&L, but I'm talking same store basis. Inflation on the top line for waste revenue, tip fees and service fees, essentially offset same store escalation in our costs. And in the EBITDA reconciliation bridge on slide 5 of the call deck, that's largely offsetting one another in that last other category. So that's what we saw. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I think as we continue to get resets in our contracts with these higher inflation indices, that will certainly help you know, move energy prices forward and get back some of that margin compression.
Okay, that's it for me. I appreciate it.
Our next question comes from Yana Manalkian with Vibrant Capital Partners. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, my questions have actually already been answered. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Eric Gatto with PineBridge. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, I just have a few more questions on your hedges. How much, I guess, mean capacity do you have that you can use as collateral for your hedges in lieu of cash and LCs?
Sorry, if you could you, we're just dealing with a technical issue. Could you repeat your question?
Yeah, sure. I was just wondering how much mean capacity do you actually have that you can use to post collateral for your hedges in lieu of cash and letters of credit?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's uncapped.
It is. Oh, it is uncapped.
Okay. Yeah, it is. Uncapped.
It's uncapped in the credit agreement. Correct. Right.
Got it. Okay. And so I guess if forward curves continue to move up here, would that change your strategy with entering into new hedges to preserve some of that liquidity, or could you possibly issue more secured debt instead to capitalize on that opportunity?
You know, I think we'll have to make those decisions as you know the facts evolve. you bring up a good question about our desire to enter into new hedges. I'll take a little bit of a step back. So, you know, we have an energy risk management program that has, you know, for many years, you know, served us very well and continues to serve us well. You know, you have to take the good with the bad. You know, when prices are going up or down and you're deciding to take risk off the table. But the way we've typically operated under that program is we roll hedges in on a rolling basis over a 36-month time horizon to where we're typically entering a year, so first 12 months, about 80% hedged, and then significantly less hedged in years two and three, and we'll leg into those over time. We actually deviated from that strategy for the first time late last year as the forward curves continued moving higher, you know, with the upcoming EQT ownership transition, you know, we decided to go ahead and take more risk off the table from an energy price perspective. Prices at that time on a forward basis were much higher than anyone had ever anticipated, so we went ahead and locked those in. And that left us in a position where, again, as I mentioned, we're essentially 80% hedged now out over 3 years. I suspect what we'll do over time is, revert back to what we've always done, which is take more of a gradual average into it approach, and deal with it that way. So, but the reality is, you know, we have a hedge book that's larger than it ever would have been, and so that's what we're dealing with now. And as forward prices for those time periods continue to move forward, those are potential create potential collateral calls that we're gonna need to deal with, and we're you know dealing with right now in terms of as I said before, trying to establish excess liquidity far in excess of what we would ever expect to need under those hedges.
Right. Okay. And should we expect, I guess, a good amount of this restricted cash to be released next year after the summer and winter seasons?
So two things. Just to clarify, the restricted cash that's on the balance sheet, that primarily underpins the Term Loan C, the synthetic LC facility. So that'll always be there. And that nets against the Term Loan C on the balance sheet. As far as cash that we have posted with counterparties, yes. I mean, the way this naturally works is, of course, as we move forward and the hedges are settled, they're settled in conjunction with physical generation, and so that as they're settled, the collateral gets returned. So in the normal course, that collateral winds down over time. You know, what that doesn't contemplate, of course, is additional collateral needs to the extent that forward prices move up beyond where they are today. And that's what we're preparing for, or have prepared for.
Okay, got it. All right, that's it for me. Thank you.
Again, if you have a question, please press star then one. Our next question comes from Oscar Olivius with Allspring Global Investments. Please go ahead with your question.
Good morning. Just some more additional questions on your hedging agreements. Can you disclose how many counterparties you have, and then how many of those are crossover lenders on your RBL?
Yeah, I'll look at Isabel, I'll look at Jim. It's about 15 counterparties, and a small handful are also lenders under our credit agreement or our banks that are used to operating in a similar way.
Okay, and then in terms of the power markets that you're experiencing, maybe the higher forward markets, PGM, NYSO, and you have an other segment as well. Can you maybe touch on which one of those is driving the increased hedging demand collateral demand?
Sure. Yeah, it's PJM and New England.
And you're just selling the power, right? You're not taking like other types of hedging exposure.
No, exactly. This is very, very vanilla in the scheme of things. We're selling power. You know, as I mentioned, we're not buying fuel. You know, our fuel is our biggest revenue source. So we're just selling power. We're then entering into floating to fixed swaps with counterparties, which we then settle when we deliver physical generation to the grid.
Got it. Maybe switching over to your metals business. I know other operators in different businesses have experienced issues with shipping times. Was there any kind of timing that impacted that business where maybe you would have had higher revenues that you might experience or might benefit from in the second quarter?
Not materially.
Okay. And final question in terms of just overall growth opportunities, that would be funded with free cash flow, but is there anything that maybe on the books that wasn't on the books from first quarter? Or earlier in the, but when you had your call for fourth quarter?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by on the book.
Like new projects, something that you have signed on to construct or to add in one of your segments that maybe you didn't have as a growth project when you had your fourth quarter call earlier this year.
Oh, okay. No, nothing material.
All right. Thank you.
Our next question is a follow-up question with Nikhil Jain with Genworth Financial. Please go ahead with your question.
Yeah, thank you. So just a question on the tipping fee. What typically drives the growth in the tipping fee? Is it just the escalation clauses in the contracts, or is there something else in the market that we should be thinking about?
So for a contract that's existing, of course, it's the escalation that's built into the contract, typically tied to an inflation escalator. For Covanta, the overwhelming driver of higher tip fees, now as a trend over many years, is shifting supply and demand dynamics in the waste disposal market, in our case, specifically in the Northeast. Essentially, we have our assets, which provide a unique sustainable solution. We have our assets located very uniquely relative to the competition in and around the areas where the waste is generated, in and around the major metropolitan areas. Our biggest customers as a company, you just run down the Amtrak line from Boston to Washington. So City of Boston, City of New York, City of Philadelphia, City of Washington D.C., New Jersey, Connecticut, Long Island. That's our bread and butter from a municipal solid waste perspective. And in those markets, you have less and less landfill capacity. And not only have you had less and less landfill capacity, it is almost inconceivable that you would ever have anything but less and less landfill capacity. So our competition is a landfill that increasingly is out of state, which imposes transportation costs, obviously, and those transportation costs are only getting more expensive. So you think about that as a competitive and pricing wedge for us. As we're negotiating with our customers on long-term contracts, we're doing that against the backdrop of the reality of the market, which is You know, we have significant disposal capacity that's increasingly scarce in these markets, and that then that drives the economic fundamentals of disposal contracts. So that's really been the driver for us.
Got it. Thank you. And just one clarification: the muni waste, how is that impacted in a recession? Is there any the components in there which are tied to, like, you know, industrial kind of manufacturing or, you know, production that may get impacted in a recession?
Yeah. So what you see in I mean, it's hard to remember the last time we had a recession. But you know what you see in those time periods is waste generation does go down a little bit. You know, it goes and as you'd expect, it goes down in primarily in the commercial and industrial sectors, but also to a degree residential. You know, but it goes down very modestly. If you look at the chart of waste generation generally through the global financial crisis, it was a blip in waste generation. But I think the more important point for us is I'm talking overall waste generation. Our capacity is a small fraction of overall waste in the market, and our capacity is positioned where, you know, we're the first priority outlet for that waste with our customers and in our markets. So even through a recession, you know, we may see, you know, particular customers on an individual basis, you know, may bring less waste than they otherwise would have. But overall, our plants are full. Our plants, you know, have never been anything but full, with multiples of our waste capacity available in the market that we can't take because we have fixed capacity. And that's the waste that ends up getting on a truck and traveling hundreds of miles to a landfill.
Got it. Thank you.
Sure.
This concludes our question and answer session. I would like to turn the conference back over to Brad for any closing remarks.
Thanks, operator, and thanks to everyone for joining us on the call. We appreciate all of the interest and all of the questions, and to the extent that we weren't clear about anything or other questions arise, you know, please reach out you know, directly to Jim is the most efficient, and everyone, please have a healthy and safe long weekend. Thank you.
The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.